This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. That old Greek philosopher Socrates is famous for saying that the secret to wisdom is to know that I know not, and to ask questions. Well, some 2,500 years later, the Harvard dean said essentially the same thing to a graduating class, and the message went viral. It echoed all around our country. There's a reason why so many people have latched on. This hour on Point, why asking questions is essential. You can join us on air or online. Is this your mantra to yourself, to your kids? Are more questions in a time of angry rhetoric what the world needs right now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is James Ryan. He's dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education. His commencement speech last year was so popular on the internet, he followed it up with a book just out. It's called Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions. And if you go to our website, onpointradio.org, you'll find a link to that now famous speech and to an excerpt from the book. Jim Ryan, great to have you.
Thanks very much, Jane. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, great to have you. I want to play a clip from that now famous speech. Here you are at the Harvard Graduate School of Education last summer, describing the first of your five questions.
The first is a question my kids are fond of asking, and it's one you may have heard other teenagers pose, or maybe you still pose it yourself. The question is the classic, wait, what? It could be asked as, wait, what? Or, wait, what? My kids typically pose this question when I get to the point in a conversation where I'm asking them to do a chore or two. From their perspective, they hear me saying, blah, 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 and then tomorrow I'd like you to clean your room. And at that precise moment, the question comes, wait, what? Clean what?
Wait, what? It's the first question, the title of your book. Congratulations on its success.
Oh, thanks very much.
So it started as this speech. You're asked to deliver speeches every year. What prompted this one?
So I have been interested in questions my entire life. Like most kids, I started my life out by asking why. The difference was I never stopped asking questions. And I asked so many when I was a kid that my father told me from a very early age I had better become a lawyer because he couldn't imagine me earning a living any other way. And so when it came time to give my graduation speech last year, I thought, why not talk about a subject that has occupied my attention for an incredibly long time?
And boy, has this message resonated. It's been viewed more than 8 million times on Harvard's Facebook page. You surprised by the interest in this?
I was very surprised. The point of the speech was a general one that I think we spend far too much time worrying about having the right answers and not enough time thinking about the right questions to ask. And in my view, an answer can only be as good as the question that's asked. But instead of just staying at that level of abstraction, I thought, well, why don't I give some concrete examples of questions that I think are useful? And they're questions, honestly, that I ask myself and others all the time. Wait, what? I wonder, couldn't we at least? How can I help? And what truly matters? I had no idea that the questions would resonate with so many other people. So I was truly surprised that the speech went viral.
In fact, you've heard from, so many people, students, business executives, pastors. They all found the questions useful, right? Useful.
Yeah, I think that's right. So you're right. I got a lot of emails from people all across the country from all walks of life. You mentioned some of them. I heard from teachers. I heard from students. I heard from parents. I heard from business executives. I heard from lawyers and judges and pastors, all of whom explained to me how and why they found the questions useful. So some teachers turned the questions into posters that they hung in their classrooms. Some business executives told me that they had organized retreats around the questions.
Right.
One business executive told me that the motto in their office had become, couldn't we at least? So for one reason or another, the questions seem to have struck a chord.
You promise in the book, you start the book with a promise that if you get into the habit of asking these five questions, that you will live a happier and more successful life.
Yeah, I do think that's true. I mean, you know, this is no guarantee that you just ask these questions and you're going to be completely happy and successful. But I do think that the questions cover a lot of important territory. Mm-hmm. So they cover topics like understanding, generosity, connection, progress, and focus. And I think if you are staying focused on those particular topics, it likely will increase your happiness and your chances of success.
We'll go through these five questions throughout the hour, but start with the first one, the one we heard your clip about. Wait, what? You say it's an effective way to ask for clarification for true understanding about some matter.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. My kids do ask that question an awful lot. The first time I heard it was when I was in college, and one of my roommates from Canada asked that question all the time. I think it's a question that's easy to brush off as sort of silly or asked by someone who's not paying attention. But the reason that I love it is because of the formulation. So the wait that precedes the what is a signal to slow down to make sure that you actually understand what someone is saying. And I think that in today's times, that's an especially useful skill to cultivate. I feel like too often we hear just enough to decide very quickly whether we agree or disagree with someone, and then we just dismiss someone with whom we disagree or disparage them as either ignorant or evil or both. And if we instead took a little more time to figure out what someone is trying to say, why they are saying it, why they hold certain beliefs, there's no guarantee that you're going to end up agreeing all the time, but you're likely to end up respecting why someone holds a particular view. Mm. I just think that's an incredibly important skill to cultivate and one that seems pretty lacking these days.
You mentioned a minute or so ago that an answer can only be as good as the question that is asked. I mean, Einstein famously talked about spending time asking the right questions, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Einstein famously said that if he had an hour to solve a problem and his life depended on it, he would spend the first 55 minutes thinking of the right question to ask, because once he had the right question, it would only take him 5 minutes to solve the problem. Now, I mean, I feel like if you're not Einstein, you might want to leave a little more time to solve the problem than 5 minutes. But I think the point is exactly right, that thinking about the right question is hard. I mean, you would know this. You ask people questions for a living.
Right.
And
right.
To get good answers, you have to think about the right questions to ask.
Sometimes based on your circumstance in life, the answers are hard to hear. I mean, you may not want to know the answer, so you may not want to ask the question, right? I mean, it's important to recognize that you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think one of the reasons that the book resonated with people is that the questions are so simple, which means that they're really easy to remember. And across a lot of contexts, if you're stuck on something, one of these questions is likely to help you make some progress, even thinking through what you're facing.
So question number one,
Wait,
what? Which can be asked with many different inflections, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons why it's so useful. You can ask it in a lot of different ways.
I'm hearing my 12-year-old
right
now. Question number two, I wonder, which you say is the heart of all curiosity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I wonder is not a full question, of course. It's the start of a number of questions, but it can be paired with why or if. So I wonder why or I wonder if. And as I explained in the book, my observation is that most kids start out very curious about the world but become less so over time. And I think that's a real loss. And if you remind yourself to ask, I wonder why, when you're looking around, when you meet someone new, it's a way to remind yourself to remain curious. And remaining curious, I think, is a way to remain engaged in the world.
Remain curious and also to think about how you might improve the world or really your corner of the world, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's also right. So the two questions are linked, I wonder why and I wonder if, right? So if you see something and you wonder, well, why is this happening? and you're not satisfied with the answer, that's likely to prompt the next question, which is, I wonder if. So, you know, whether it's something at work or something at home, like, I wonder why we do it this way, or I wonder why this exists this way. And you're not satisfied. You might think, well, I wonder if we could do this differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, in your last segment, you know, I think folks at United probably are thinking right now, they should have asked, I wonder if we could have handled this differently. Mm-hmm.
Let's get a call in here. Mike in Baltimore. You're on the air with Jim Ryan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, fine. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that asking questions is probably one of the most important things that we can do. My father taught me the most dangerous word in the English language is the word why. So I've been asking questions about everything all my life, and it's become a life philosophy to the point that I actually have a tattoo that says, question everything.
Jim, do you have any tattoos you want to reveal on the internet?
I haven't tattooed any of the questions yet. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the question why. When I was a law student, the very first class I took, the professor walked in, and the very first thing he told us was that there is one simple question that is all important to ask as you study the law, and that question is why. And his point was, you can't just understand what the legal rules are. You have to understand whether the legal rules make sense. And the way to do that is to ask, well, why is the rule that way? And once you start asking that, you are naturally going to ask, well, couldn't the rule be different if you're not satisfied with the way it is? So I think that is that's why I think it's one of the essential questions.
Mike, thanks so much for the call. So, Jim, you've asked a lot of questions in your life and, of course, through the writing of this book. What's the one question you'd still like to ask of someone, anyone, about anything?
I think the question that I like to ask in a lot of different contexts, and it's not directed at a particular person, is couldn't we at least? I just find that this question is a way to invite connections that might not otherwise exist. So couldn't we at least agree? You know, in the field of education, there are an awful lot of debates that I think could be, the temperature could be lowered if more people asked about what they agree about.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the value of asking questions in life, at work, in school, at home, in politics, and more. And you can join the conversation. Is asking questions the secret sauce in your profession? Doctor, scientist, policeman, teacher, priest. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour is Jim Ryan, Dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education. His new book is called Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions. I want to play another clip here, Jim. This is another moment from your graduation speech last year. You're warning graduates that going out to do good in the world as educators is a good thing, but to beware of the savior complex of seeing themselves too much as heroes. And this is where you bring in question number 4.
We shouldn't let the real pitfalls of the savior complex extinguish one of the most humane instincts there is, the instinct to lend a hand. But how we help matters as much as that we do help. And if you ask, how can I help? You're asking with humility for direction, and you are recognizing that others are experts in their own lives and that they will likely help you as much as you help them.
I love this one. How can I help? You're asking with humility for direction.
Right. I think that the instinct to lend a hand is definitely one of the most humane instincts. But I think we need to be cautious about assuming we know what someone else needs. And I do think it's a sign of humility and a sign of respect to begin by asking, how can I help? And to let the person to whom you're offering assistance give you some direction. You know, I love the Moth podcast.
Yes.
And I heard a terrific story about an elderly woman who lived in a New York City apartment building and was very independent and self-sufficient until she had a stroke. And then she had to lean a bit on her neighbors who responded beautifully. And she was grateful for their help, but she made a point of saying that she was incredibly grateful that they began by asking her, how can I help? They didn't assume that they knew what she needed. And as she explained, it allowed her to maintain some independence and dignity.
Right. Remaining, you're still in charge, right? Recognizing, asking that question and recognizing that others are experts in their own lives, maybe, and that you're just helping them create an opportunity to remain in charge of their life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's also likely to make your help more effective if you begin by asking how you can help. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell this story in the book. I mean, this is a slightly humorous story, but I think it's something that happens all the time, about my cousin Tracy, who, when she would have a bad day at work, she would come home and tell her boyfriend about it. And he would immediately leap in and try to solve the problems that she confronted at work.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a fixer. And what she really needed was just someone to listen and commiserate about her day. And if he had said instead, well, how can I help? She would have probably just said, well, it would just be helpful if you just listened.
Yeah. True. You clerked at the Supreme Court for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. What did you learn about asking questions from your experience listening to questioning at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I learned a great deal. I mean, to go back to the first question of wait, what? One of the most effective questioners on the court when I was clerking was Justice Stevens. And we would get to sit in on oral arguments. And Justice Stevens had a knack for asking the question that broke open the case. And he asked it in a very polite way. And the question that he asked was essentially a version of, wait, what? And by that, he would ask the lawyers to slow down and to try to really make a link in their argument that wasn't there. That is, he saw the weakness, but instead of coming out in a bombastic manner and arguing with them, he would slowly ask them the question, well, could you explain this and how do these two things add up? And you would slowly realize that he had hit on the weakest part of the case.
And so the different styles of the justices lend different questioning and different, maybe different answers in the court.
I think that's right. And I actually think that his particular approach, which was humble and polite, was actually more effective because it required the lawyers to answer questions that were incredibly difficult to answer. If instead, you know, some of the justices had more aggressive styles and would come right out and begin arguing rather than asking questions, and that often didn't reveal the weakest parts of a lawyer's case, which is a big part of what oral argument is all about. And for that reason, I think asking questions and particularly wait what is not only a way to gain understanding and clarification, it's also a pretty effective way to get people thinking about changing their own minds, right? So if you think, if you come right off the bat and when you hear something say, well, I completely disagree or I think that's a really dumb point, the person you're talking to is probably just going to dig in their heels. But if instead you start asking questions along the lines of, wait, what? In terms of, well, why do you believe that? And what's that based on? You might get them to start thinking, well, maybe I don't have a good reason for believing that. I'm not saying that this is going to magically convince people to change their minds, but I think it's a more effective way than coming right out of the gates and telling someone they're completely wrong. Mm.
So I ask this next question, recognizing your background at an Ivy League, at Harvard, you know, sort of the bastion of liberalism in Boston, of all places, right? A woman from our website asks, many questions that are out there, the questions that are being suppressed are from the other side, the real hard questions that no one wants to even broach, from immigration to the wage gap to education to all of it. Only liberal questions are being asked. What do you say to that listener who suggests that maybe the conservative tone or content of you know, the other side's questions are not welcome?
I don't know that I've seen suppression of questions from one side or the other. But I do think that asking hard questions is absolutely crucial, especially in an academic setting. We should not be afraid to ask questions and to answer them honestly. I mean, what we try to do at the Harvard Graduate School of Education is ask hard questions about education and answer them with research and evidence and follow the research and evidence wherever it might lead. I think that's exactly what an academic institution ought to be doing, but it's also what government officials ought to be doing. I mean, there's no reason, I think, to say that certain questions are out of bounds. You may have very different answers, but to say that a particular question shouldn't be asked, I think, is the wrong way to go.
Do you see something happening in America, a closing in on both sides, if you will, a lack of interest or ability to ask good questions, even to question our own beliefs to some extent?
Yeah, I do think that we have a difficult time talking with people with whom we don't already agree. And I think that in some respects, social media is making it very easy to be in echo chambers, whether you're on the left or the right. And so we don't have actually a lot of opportunities to come in contact, and we can avoid opportunities to come in contact with people with whom we don't agree.
So how can we learn to listen better as a people when we are when there are so many filters, when we tend to congregate, you know, in our own silos, as you say, and confirm really our existing opinions?
I think it's a combination of remaining curious and overcoming fear. So I think on the first, we ought to remain curious about the views of those with whom we disagree. And we ought to overcome our fear of having hard conversations. And, you know, people, I don't think, are drawn to conflict. And I think it takes practice to have a productive disagreement.
A productive disagreement without screaming or flame throwing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's much easier to do that on, you know, when you're sitting in front of your computer than when you're sitting face to face with someone.
A lot of listeners want to get in here, Jim Ryan. Let's get Bill in here from Newton, Mass. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Jane. Hi, Dean Ryan.
Hi.
Just a couple of points, I think, and then a couple of them have been made mention to. In addition to asking the right questions, I think not enough emphasis exists everywhere on actually listening to the answer without prejudice. Asking presumes listening. However, it doesn't often occur.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to clear our minds, slow down, try to avoid distraction, and listen to the person's answer without assuming, without bringing your own point of view. And I think it's okay now not to feel exclusively one way or another. Mm-hmm. It should be, and if you don't really feel completely one way or the other, that's okay. I think we all feel great pressure to be on one side or the other, far right, far left, or strictly in the mm-hmm. middle without a point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I completely agree. And part of what I talk about in the book is listening for good questions. And in some respects, this goes back to the point that Jane was making before. We shouldn't be offended when someone asks a question. Sometimes they might ask it in an awkward way or in a way that seems overly aggressive. But if we're generous listeners, and I think that's what we should strive to be, we'll see in the questions some genuine curiosity. And when we ask someone else questions, you're exactly right, that we should give the person an opportunity to provide an answer and listen without judging first.
Bill, thank you very much. Here's Jackie in Fayetteville, New York. Hi, Jackie. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. I found it interesting in my academic career that at Seattle University, which was very much Jesuit, I was encouraged to ask the right question and to continue to question so that I could, you know, increase my knowledge. And then doing my doctorate at a Buddhist university, I was taught that one must live the question. And I wanted to hear if Dean had any comment on that.
Oh, that's interesting. Jackie, thank you.
I'm not entirely sure what it means to live the question, but if it is to embody a stance where you are questioning all the time, I couldn't agree more.
Jackie, thanks. How can curriculum encourage good question asking in children?
Yeah, so that's a great point. I think that there are a couple of ways. One is that it can be built right into the curriculum. So there are curricula that are inquiry-based, where the lessons are all built around answering questions. And then there's a related approach that's usually called project-based learning, where students have to produce something at the end of the lesson. It could be a paper, it could be a short film, it could be a diorama. Anything can constitute a project. And in order to do that, they've got to learn the material necessary to be successful at completing the project. And along the way, they're necessarily going to ask questions. And I think what the lesson is from project-based learning is that if you can spark curiosity in kids, you will spark questions.
So as an expert in education yourself, what's been your experience with asking good questions in the classroom?
I think it's absolutely crucial. You know, I spent 15 years as a law professor. I fulfilled my dad's prophecy and became a lawyer and then a law professor, in part because I absolutely loved the Socratic method and the way of teaching students through questions. And what I noticed when done right, and it's a difficult thing to do right, and I didn't always get it right by any means, but when done right, you can see the light bulbs going off in the student's head, that they are coming to the answers through their own thinking that is in turn encouraged by asking good questions.
Here's Peter in Cambridge, Vermont. Hi, Peter. You're on the air with Jim Ryan.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Peter.
I was up on a dirt road. Yes, I live in the rural part of Vermont, and it's extremely busy here with animals and vegetation in the summertime. There's a lot of observational life for me, and I am recording a new album of 13 original songs at 56 years old called Question This. The lead song is Question This, Answer That. Do we get our wisdom from a Cheshire cat? And it goes on from there. But I was taught as a kid who, what, when, where, why, and how. And then I was watching the Cider House Rules some years ago, and the lead character was told to be of use every day. And the concept there was to ask, to learn the question, what is of use? Mm. But that sometimes can compete with what is just of interest and just of intrigue. I went to college without it. Concept of what job I'd get afterwards. I just went to study.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the early 80s. So nowadays it's all about the job and whatnot. But yeah, that might be useful.
Peter, thank you so much. Quick question. This could be question number 6 for you, Jim.
Yeah. First tattoos, and then set to song.
Exactly. Let's get Andrew in here from Boca Raton, Florida. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
This is a very interesting topic, actually. My undergrad is in philosophy, so this is very interesting. And I'd like your feedback as well on, you know, one question I also think is very powerful is, you know, the question, you know, is it moral? And kind of using, you know, an immediate example with, for example, you know, the debate about the Affordable Care Act, right? Like, is it moral to put 23 million people's health at risk and put their lives at risk? And I just like your, you know, your thoughts on that as kind of a key question is just the morality.
Yeah. So
that.
I think that's a great point. And I think one way to get at it is by asking what truly matters. So if you think about healthcare, if you ask, well, what truly matters about healthcare policy, that is quickly going to get you into thinking about what's moral, what's effective, and the like.
Mm. Andrew, thanks so much. So question number 5 is what truly matters, as you just say, the heart of life. Asking what truly matters, you write, can just as effectively guide you through a meeting with colleagues as it can guide you through the biggest decisions of your life. It forces you to get to the heart of the issues at work or at school, at the heart of your convictions, your beliefs, your goals in this life.
I do think that's right. And you had asked me earlier about clerking and what I learned from clerking. And I clerked for William Rehnquist. And he was a remarkable man in many respects. But one thing that he did especially well was that he clearly stayed focused on what truly mattered to him. And because of that, he was incredibly efficient at work. He had an enormously important job, but he had a huge array of interests outside of his job, from his family to his varied hobbies, from writing to Gilbert and Sullivan operas to meteorology to history. And what that meant was he never wasted time. And so he was constantly asking in one form or another what truly matters. So just to give you a specific example, most of the justices asked their clerks to prepare very long memos that they would use for oral argument. And the memos were incredibly time-consuming to prepare and time-consuming to go through. The chief instead would walk with us around the block of the U.S. Supreme Court for about half an hour preparing for oral argument. And in that conversation, he would hone in on the most important questions.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/onpoint. Go now and get your first three meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom Ashbrook. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to ask you about you. At On Point, we want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous, it's easy, it'll just take a couple of minutes to complete. If you go to wbur.podcastingsurvey.com to complete the survey right now, we'd really appreciate it. That's wbur.podcastingsurvey.com. This survey will be really helpful to us, so thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour with Jim Ryan, author of a new book about all the importance of training yourself to ask questions, always ask questions, and why questions are so important. Questions like, I wonder, how can I help? What truly matters? You can join the conversation. Is there a moment in your life when asking the right question really made a difference? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Jim Ryan's new book is called Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions. And we have an excerpt of the book online at our website. Here's a clip, a segment from MSNBC's Morning Joe on December 13th, where host Joe Scarborough asked California Republican Congressman and Foreign Affairs Committee member Dana Rohrabacher why the U.S., why the Obama administration hadn't stepped in to stop the slaughter in Syria. The interview went downhill and fast.
Well, that's a question that's based on false premises,
no,
as
it's
far
not.
As I'm concerned.
No, it's
now,
not.
Here's the hint. Well, wait a minute. You want me to answer your question?
No, I just don't want now, you to wait, lie
is
on
this
my
channel,
television
Is this
show.
Channel every time they ask a question and somebody tries to answer the way they want to?
Well, no.
They interrupt
you,
that
you,
for
you
that
just
guest?
Don't let people come on the show
this
and lie.
This is what happened before. Let me put it this way
What
to
happened
you.
Before? You lied before?
Moments later, the congressman threatened to walk out of the interview unless he was given a chance to complete his answers. So that's MSNBC. Here is Fox News host Tucker Carlson getting into it last week with Lansing, Michigan mayor about the sanctuary cities controversy. Carlson kept interrupting the mayor with questions, but with hostile questions.
It's easy for white men like us to say that who are in the majority, who enjoy what we enjoy,
You've
but the fact
it.
Is...
Okay, see, I was taking you seriously at the beginning, but this is just buffoonish. Now it's like I'm a white man, so my views on this are less material
that's your,
or something?
That's your perspective. Try to walk in another man's shoes, though. Walk a mile in somebody else's shoes.
I thought
shoes.
You believed in laws.
So that remark by the mayor, walk in another man's shoes, isn't that another way of saying, I wonder why?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, and those two clips... are a good example of what I was talking about earlier, where we don't seem able to have genuine conversations. I can understand why the media become impatient with politicians who are sticking to their talking points and not asking the questions. But it does seem to me that we would all be better off if we lowered the temperature a little bit in these conversations and allowed someone to answer a question. And if you have follow-ups, ask a follow-up question. I mean, a caller talked about the importance of listening to the answer first. And I think that's a very good point.
It's the incivility of the dialogue, you know, that seems to have gone to a new level, Jim.
Yeah, no, I think I completely agree. And again, I think if we spent more time honestly curious about why someone holds a particular view and trying to understand why someone holds a particular view. So I wonder why someone believes this.
Where are they coming from?
Where are they
what's
coming
their experience?
From? What's behind it?
Right.
What has been their experience? Instead of trying to play gotcha from the very beginning and trying through your questions to prove a point rather than to actually give someone an opportunity to explain their own point.
Well, and the media is guilty of that, certainly.
It does seem so, certainly. And again, I understand the impatience that the media have with politicians who might not want to answer a difficult question or might just be sticking to talking points. But in some instances, I think we've gone too far in the other direction where we don't give those who are being interviewed an opportunity to explain themselves.
Let's go to Zach in Waupaca, Wisconsin. Hi, Zach. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I think this is a critical discussion to have. And this is so important. I work as a rural family physician.
Can't quite hear you, Zach. Can you put the phone to your closer?
Sure. Yep. I work as a rural family physician, and this is the work I do day in and day out, having authentic conversations with people, understanding the why. And what your caller is really describing is something that's an extension of the trans-theoretical behavioral model for change. And this is an evidence-based practice where you get people empowered to make their own decisions for the right reasons for themselves. And over time, having this conversation over time moves them along in the conversation to be empowered to come to a different conclusion than what they had in the past.
Ah, that's
not
interesting,
that
Zach. Yeah. No, thank you.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talk in the book a little bit about Atul Gawande's work on end of life and end of life care and how difficult it is for doctors to have honest conversations with those who have life limiting illnesses and make the point that if doctors got into the habit of asking their patients, how can I help? That's likely to prompt the patients to provide the sort of information that would be really useful to doctors. And it seems very similar to what you are trying to do.
Mm. Jim, thank you. Here's Mark in Binghamton, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes. I was educated abroad. I am a foreigner. And I was educated along the lines that you are discussing here, always asking questions. And don't memorize anything. Just know why things happen and keep on asking questions. Just almost like the Socratic method that you described earlier. Mm-hmm. And then you arrive to this country where in order to obtain your certifications and your licenses and your past exam, you have to submit yourself to multiple choice questions where they ask you, there is only one answer. And the answers are always the most likely, the least likely. So I had to repackage my knowledge so that I wouldn't be asking questions. I just try to fit.
Repackage it and think about it differently.
Right.
Yeah, no, I hear you, Mark. Thank you.
Well, you've hit on, in some respects, a debate that exists within education circles and the debate over what skills should we be teaching students and how important is it for them to understand particular facts. And not surprisingly, I think the answer lies somewhere in the middle, that I do think that we should be focused on instilling certain knowledge in students, but we should also be cultivating their habit of asking questions. And in part because if you think about our world today and how quickly the economy changes, students who are in 10th grade today are are going to be in jobs 20 years from now that we don't even know what they look like.
Right.
And they're going to have to be lifelong learners. Mm-hmm. And to be a lifelong learner, you have to be curious about the world and you have to think of learning as something that's interesting and engaging.
That's so interesting. We think of our kids and what they're going to be in 20, 30 years and the jobs they're going to hold. And yet I think about the technology and the distractions in our culture today, cell phones and all the rest. I mean, are we really teaching these kids to think about questions, and or does all this sort of stifle their curiosity?
Well, I think it can actually spark curiosity, but can it also, and you know this as a parent, it can also waste an enormous amount of time.
Right, right.
And I don't think kids are the only ones guilty of following one link after another and down a rabbit hole. And in some respects, the ubiquity of information and the instant availability of information, if anything, makes thinking about the right question to ask even more important. Because if you don't have a sense of what you're looking for, you could spend countless hours going down one dead end after another. And technology makes that completely easy to do.
I have to ask you about a very compelling part of the book. You were adopted as a baby.
I was.
And you write this incredible narrative about finding your biological mother all because of a question. It's an incredibly moving story. Brought me to tears, actually. Tell us a little bit about it.
So I was adopted when I was 9 days old, and it was a completely closed adoption process. And so I never knew anything about my biological parents. And I was really never that curious, in part because I had a wonderful family, wonderful parents. But when I got older and we started having kids who didn't look exactly like my wife, Katie, or me, I became a little bit curious, but didn't do anything about it until a friend encouraged me 4 years ago. And in that moment, it was really the first time I asked myself, so I wonder why I was adopted. I wonder why I was put up for adoption. And to make a very long story short, what I discovered, and this was a long process, was that my birth mother emigrated from Ireland following her brother and did not want to give me up for adoption, but worked with a family in New York City and lived with them and worked with them and couldn't keep me and thought that I needed a father. And so she gave me up for adoption. At that point, I just had papers that described the story. But when I read the story, I thought, I need to find this person and tell her that everything turned out okay and to thank her. I was never bitter about being adopted. My parents always made me feel that it was special that I was adopted. But I thought, I need to find this person and thank her. And so several months later, with the help of the adoption agency, I found her. And it turned out that she had gotten married and had 4 additional kids and that they lived 15 minutes from where I grew up, which really just completely blew me away. We had a few phone calls and finally agreed to meet, appropriately enough, given that we were both in New Jersey, at a rest stop on the Garden State Parkway. I was floored when we first met, because there's no mistaking that we are related.
You
felt
in a
like,
wig.
I felt like I was looking at myself wearing a wig. And we have developed a relationship that has completely enriched my life. And I've met all of her other children who have been incredibly welcoming to me. And I tell this story in the book because I think it's an illustration of the power of asking, I wonder why.
Kate is in Boston. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Dean Ryan. I'm actually an HDSE grad, and so I am not working as a teacher right now. That's my choice, but out of deepest respect, I respectfully question your questions from a teaching standpoint in the elementary school. What do we do when the questions are not garnering answers that we are hoping for? For example, what if, you know, a young student, say maybe third or fourth grade, to the answer to the question, what's really important? What if the answer is something like that I get what I want, or, you know, that my beliefs are always heard, you know, at these critical moments when they're really starting to put together their vision of the world, what do we do pedagogically when the answers aren't what we're hoping for? How do we push past just the question, but then how do we get them to question their answer?
Okay, yeah. Thank you. One of your graduates.
I know, and not surprisingly, you asked a great question.
Say.
So he won't be surprised that my answer is you ask more questions. You know, this comes up all the time in law school classrooms, but it works, I think, just as well in an elementary school classroom. You don't always know what the answer is going to be, or you won't always get the answer you were expecting or hoping for. But if and when that happens, that's when you ask follow-up questions and you probe. If a student says, well, what's really important to me is that I always finish first, or I always get exactly what I want, well, then you can start asking, well, I wonder why you feel that way. And I wonder if the whole classroom would work well if everyone felt that way. And it's a way to start to prompt the student to question his or her response. So I don't think that anything's gained by not asking the question because you're not sure what the answer is going to be or that it might require additional questions.
Kate, thank you. Here's Gail in Franklinville, New York. Hi, Gail. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a lifelong learner, and I just want to say that after 38 years, I went back to school as a non-traditional student to obtain my master's degree, and I found that I was a sacrificial lamb that asked all the questions the other students had but were afraid to ask, I guess, and they would thank me because they had those same questions but were reluctant to come forward and ask. So
that's such a good point, Gail. Thank you. I mean, you know, nobody wants to look dumb, right?
Absolutely. You know, and you are a teacher's dream come true, because what I've found in the classroom is that if one person has a question, there are at least a dozen others who have exactly the same question. And in some respects, part of the point of this book, and especially the emphasis on asking, I wonder why or I wonder if, is to encourage people not to be afraid to ask questions and not to be afraid to seem out of it or not following. Because there's no doubt that if you have a question, others have
somebody else
the same.
Does too.
Yeah.
All right. Five questions. Wait, what? I wonder. Couldn't we at least? How can I help? What truly matters? And then there's a bonus question, Dean Ryan.
Yeah.
What is it?
So the bonus question is, and did you get what you wanted from this life, even so? And this is a question that begins a poem by Raymond Carver called Late Fragments. And I came across it at a very sad occasion, the memorial service for one of my dearest friends, Doug Kendall, who died a couple of years ago at the age of 51 from colon cancer. And the point I make in the speech and again in the book is that if you continually ask yourself these five questions, you're likely to be in a good position to answer what I call the bonus question. And did you get what you wanted from this life? Even so. And the poem goes on to say, I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved, to feel beloved on the earth. And Doug himself was incredibly beloved, and one of the reasons he was so beloved was he asked truly great questions. As I describe in the conclusion of the book, he asked each of the five essential questions, and in doing so, he made all of his friends feel beloved. And so one way to feel beloved yourself is to make others feel beloved, and a great way to do that is by asking them good questions.
James Ryan is Dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education, author of Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions. So great to have you here. I was skeptical. I didn't know what to expect, but boy, I couldn't put that book down. It's a real treat. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me
And
on.
Millions of people have watched it online. We thank you, listeners, for calling in today as well. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.